in Parashat Mishpatim. We'll do a quick overview of our parasha. I want to do our overview differently than we usually do. I'm going to quickly read through the Sefer HaChinuch, the mitzvot of the parasha, because our parasha is really a delineation of the mitzvot of the legal system. We'll run through the proactive mitzvot, the prohibited mitzvot, and then we'll start our parasha in depth, okay? So, in our parasha, we have the mitzvah of the Hebrew servant, Eved Ivri, right, to set him free after 6 years, a maximum. The idea of an Amma Ivriya, that if a person marries a Jewish servant, a female, so then there's a mitzvah to marry her, either him or his son. There's another mitzvah to help her buy her way out of her being a servant. Then we have a mitzvah that the courts should judge a person and if they deserve the death penalty, administer it. We have the mitzvah that under certain circumstances when two people fight, so the courts have to tax the people fighting. The Torah says there's a breakdown of how a court has to rule that a person who harms his fellow man must pay. We know that he has to pay nezek, the damages, tsa'ar, the pain, sheves, the unemployment, ripui, the medical bills, and boshet, the shame. Then we have the mitzvah that if a person has to get the death penalty, Torah says there are different types of death penalty and the courts have to administer the four different death penalties when they're relevant. We know that a person will only get the death penalty if they were warned, if they did a transgression on purpose after they were warned and told that if they do it, they'll get the death penalty. Next, the Torah gives us the mitzvah of the laws of monetary damage from our animals. So that means if a person's animal pushed someone else, gored someone else, sat on someone else, stepped on someone else, ate someone else's object or field, so the owner is reliable, the owner is responsible for paying for the damages. Next, the Torah gives us the mitzvah of the damages of a pit. Now, the pit means if a person digs a pit in public domain and people fall inside and get damaged. So the guy could say, it's not my house, it's not my property, it's a pit in public domain. So the Torah tells you, no, if you created that pit in the public domain, even if you just uncovered a pothole and someone falls in and gets damaged, so the person is responsible for paying for the damages of that pit. And we will see that it's not only a pit. There are other damages included in that. Next, the mitzvah of ruling on circumstances where a person stole. So there's a special tax. If a person steals, they have to pay back double. If a person kidnaps, they get the death penalty. We have the mitzvah of dealing with the damages of an animal that tramples on someone else's field or consumes. We discussed that. The mitzvah of Beis Din dealing with the damages of a fire. A person could argue, what did I do? The wind moved the fire. I just made a barbecue. I made a bonfire in my own yard. The fire spread. What does that have to do with me? No, person's responsible for a fire they create. Next, we have the laws of a shomer chinam. What's a shomer chinam? I'm going to watch over your object. So you want to run out and catch mincha. You leave me your laptop and you say, can you keep an eye on it? I say, yes. What responsibilities do I have? So that's called shomer chinam. I'm watching it for free. So my responsibility is not to be negligent. If I let someone put down a cup of coffee right next to it, or if I knock over that cup of coffee, if I drop it, if I push it off the table and it hits the floor. So when a person's negligent, he's chayav. Is he responsible if it gets stolen? He's watching it, it's in his house, and he closed his front door the way he always does, and he comes back after 5 minutes, it was stolen. so he's not responsible. So he wasn't paid for watching over it. So long as he wasn't negligent, so long as he watched it the way you watch your objects, so then he's not responsible for gneva v'aveda. If he were paid for guarding it, then we'd say you have to guard it better. You have to do what's necessary to ensure it doesn't get stolen. Within a range of normalcy. But you weren't paid, you're shomer chinam, so that's the next mitzvah. The laws of Shomer Chinam. What about if a person says it was stolen, but really he himself stole it? So there are special laws about how the court deals with that, because the guy wants to use the laptop for himself. So he says it was stolen, and then he leaves it at home. So the Torah says he has to take a vow. That's called Shvuat HaShomrim. The Shomer Chinam has to take a vow that he didn't take it. Next, we have the laws of Shomer Sachar. What happens if I go to park my car at a paid parking garage? So I'm paying them to watch my car, right? And then I come back and the car was stolen. So what do they say? We're sorry, mister. We don't know how they did it. And I say, what do you mean you're sorry? I paid you to watch my car. If it got stolen, you're responsible. So if armed robbers walk in, you know, a gang shows up with Uzis and M16s, and then they take out all the cars from the parking lot, so then they did what they had to. They don't have to have an army there in case a gang shows up with Uzis and M16s, right? That they're not accountable for. But if it was a regular theft, so then we say, excuse me, that's what you were paid to watch. That's the idea of a shomer sachar, a watcher who's being paid. So he's responsible for gneva v'aveda. What happens if you rented a vehicle? You rented something from someone else. So you're paying him for the usage of it. So then we say you're still responsible to make sure it doesn't get stolen. So shomer sachar, a socher, a person who rents an object, has the same responsibility as a shomer sachar. Next we have the laws in the Torah of a shoel. People are very funny about this. They borrow an object, and then they think they can say all kinds of excuses. The Torah says if you borrowed something, you have the utmost responsibility. You borrowed it. He was nice to you. He let you use his car. People say, I'm sorry, it got stolen. Well, you're sorry, you have to pay. I'm sorry, all kinds of things happened. The only time you have what to talk about is if you could say, there were things beyond my control. You don't understand, lightning hit the car. I couldn't do anything about it. Then you have what to talk about. But our general assumption is, a shoel, you borrowed it, you have the utmost liability. The guy was nice to you, it's all in your benefit, you have the utmost liability. Next we move on. The Torah tells us the laws of a mifate, that if a person seduces a young girl, so then the Torah says that he has to pay a special tax, and he must marry her unless she doesn't want to marry him. But if she wants to marry him, he's responsible for marrying her. Now we're going to quickly go over to the prohibitions in our parsha. Prohibition number one is if a person bought a girl who was a servant, right? So he's not allowed to sell her to someone else. Chazal said, Hashem wants you to be nice and loving to this girl. She's coming from a family where she's underprivileged. So the Torah wanted you to even marry her if possible. You're certainly not supposed to put her on the slave market, sell her on. You bought her, the understanding is you bought her to help her out. So help her out. You don't want to marry her? Fine. So at least don't sell her onward. Torah says, what happens if you do marry her? Special prohibition. You got to treat her like your regular wife. You cannot give her less. Less of what? So here the Torah actually reveals to us what a husband owes his wife. You cannot give her less time together. A husband owes his wife time together. You can't give her less food. You have your prime wife, you eat prime rib with her. You have your secondary wife, you give her leftovers. You give her cereal with milk. No, says the Torah. Treat her the same way. Don't you sit there eating steaks and leave her with cereal. You have to give her clothing. What does it mean you have to give her clothing? Whatever the norm is in the society. If you live in a society where every woman buys two new outfits every Yom Tiv, so your wife shouldn't feel less than anyone else. She has to have adequate clothing for the summer and the winter, and that goes with the norm of society. And you have to have intimate time with her. A person can't say, we're married, I'm taking good care of you, we have kids, I'll see you next year. Whatever you need, your needs are taken care of. No, there's an amount in time of intimacy that a husband owes his wife, and the Torah warns us that if the guy takes the girl who was a maid in the house, he shouldn't treat her less than any husband treats his wife. This is where the Torah reveals to us what every husband owes his wife. Yes, sir. I didn't hear you. We're talking about, when I say a maid, I mean a girl that was sold to be a servant in the house. No, that's if you marry her, you owe her the time. We're talking about a situation where he married her. And the Torah says, treat her like your wife. Here's what you owe your wife. Treat her the same way. No, she's a wife. She's not your maid anymore. Gabarno.
So if that involves clothing, you ask her to do something, you would like to do the same thing.
Let's start again. We're talking about a situation where he married her.
No, but you said she also has a right to intimacy.
Right.
Does that mean that if you say, I really like it if you do this to me, some folks say that do the same thing?
Every husband and wife, within their marriage, have to figure out what they're both comfortable with. How much does one owe the other? We could discuss that on Thursday night. She's no different than any other wife. The limitation is that people have to be respectful of one another. Respectful means we try to please, both sides should want to please the other. It's a type of system where it only works if each side wants to give. Meaning, if one side comes in and says, you should be trying to please me, that'll never work. It can only work if both sides want to be on the giving end. Being on the giving end also means not making requests that the other side is uncomfortable with, but it's far more complex than that. We move on. It's a topic that needs to be discussed before you get married. It's a topic which people sometimes are shy to discuss, but it's important. Find a rabbi you're comfortable with and discuss it. It is important. We move on. The Torah prohibits hitting a parent. And this involves any time a child would cause a parent to bleed. Obviously, this gets complicated when parents need all kinds of medical attention and the child is going to administer it. So if you're a doctor and a parent needs an operation, that's one question. But if you have your parent over and they have diabetes and they need to get pricked every day, or sometimes they need shots given every day, so we have a baseline of a prohibition that I'm not allowed to cause my parents to bleed. Now they have a medical need. So when it's possible, we take someone else to do it. If it's possible, even for the daughter-in-law to do it. Meaning, if the son-in-law or daughter-in-law could do it, that's better, because their own child has a special prohibition not to cause them to bleed. But sometimes the parent says, I'm more comfortable with you. Or a different scenario, I'll get you in a minute, Gilad. A family once asked me, they had a parent who needed medical attention that involved being given a shot every number of hours a day, having their blood sugar level checked a number of times a day. And so they said, really, the grandkids could do it. They were grandchildren who were old enough. Really, the son-in-law could do it. But the one who was taking care of them primarily was their daughter. So they asked how should they run it. So I'm going to explain the answer, because it teaches us a very important concept in practical application of halacha. Okay? So on the theoretical level, we just discussed, it would be much better if the son-in-law did it. It would be much better if the grandchild did it. It would be much better if someone else did it instead of their own daughter. However, what's my concern? They need the shot given at 10 o'clock in the morning. The daughter's going to come in. and see that her parents need the shot, her father, her mother, whatever, needs the shot. She's going to say, just a second, I'll get my husband. Now we have to remember, this is a scenario that repeats itself every morning, right? Every morning at 10 o'clock, someone has to give them the shot. The son is out working. So she's going to call him and say, hey, when you have a minute, drop by, Dad needs the shot. What might happen? Twice a week he'll get his shot, an hour late, 2 hours late. Once a week they're going to forget. In the course of a month, the guy's health might deteriorate because she didn't do it. So I said to the daughter, I said, look, you are only allowed to give it over to your husband if he's in the room. If you have to leave the room and go call him, you give the shot. What's the logic? I know that once or twice a week or once or twice a month, when she goes to call her husband, she'll forget. And when she forgets, she's endangering their lives. They need this treatment. So to say, halachically, it's better if the son-in-law gives it. That's true. But I'm only willing to say, to take that into account when I'm confident I'm not risking the man's life for this. So a mother's running a whole house, plus she's dealing with her parents, and then we're going to tell her, but make sure your husband's always the one to give the shot. What's going to happen practically? Their health is going to deteriorate. The halacha didn't mean for that. So I told her, your rule is, if they're in the room with you at the time, let them do it. If they're not there at the time, you do it. Why? Because practically, that's part of the pikuach nefesh. Realistically, we're human. Sometimes the phone rings, sometimes the baby starts crying. There will be times where their health will fail because of it. They won't get the shots they need. So that when we ask a question, when we deal with the halacha, we also have to look at the practical applications. Theoretically, yes, the son-in-law should do it. Practically, if it's something that comes up often, you have to discuss it with your local Orthodox rabbi. What's the reality? What's the practical way to deal with this? We move on. The Torah tells us that if an ox gored, so then it gets executed by the courts. And it doesn't have to be an ox. Any animal that kills gets executed. What happens if the owner runs to the butcher and says, shech this animal for me quickly? So the Torah says once the animal is deserving of the death penalty of being executed, then even if it was slaughtered, you cannot enjoy the meat. You bury it. You don't eat the meat. Torah warns us about a witch. Don't let a witch stay alive. So a lot of stories have been surfacing. A lot of stories have been surfacing in the last half a year about people who encounter demons and all kinds of stories of sorcery. And especially in this class, this group, I've been having an unusual amount of people telling me that they encountered all kinds of things. Now, I was debating with myself, because so many people said so many stories that, I don't know, I got another story this week, which I'm not going to tell you. this one, no, hey. You want the story? I just prefer doing parsha. What?
That's how the channel should be.
It's yeah.
About
what if your parents are trying to hurt you? Or if they're bad to you?
So, let's discuss that Thursday night. Saying it's too... it's too broad a topic. I'll just tell you one story. There are too many stories. I'll tell you one quick story. You want the story from this week? That's what's important to you. Who cares? I'll tell you a different story. We had once... there was a guy here who... I don't remember what his issues were, but he went to get alternative medicine, alternative counseling, by an alumni of ours, an alumnus of our department. And he tells me that it's working. I said, really, what did he do? So he said, he sat with me and he lit candles and then he called to the dead and then he did, I don't remember what. So I said, next time you go to treatment by him, tell him that I said that he should get killed, that he deserves the death penalty. So he was doing alternative treatment with this guy, and part of what he was doing was he was making the room dark and lighting candles and then asking all kinds of questions from all kinds of spirits and the dead, and the student felt like a lot of his issues were getting resolved. So I said to him, that's very nice, but I think that this alumnus of ours deserves the death penalty for what he's doing. So it worked. A day later, I get a phone call from this alumnus of ours. Did you say I should get killed? I said, maybe. He said, why? I said, because part of the prohibition of idol worship is that you can't do sorcery and you can't talk to the dead, and it's a mitzvah in Torah, and it's very possible that what you're doing is an issur d'oraisa, and it's very possible it's not only an issur d'oraisa, it's a chiyuv misa, and it could be, it's part of avodah zarah. So I'm mentioning this because people are very tempted by all kinds of things, and you have to realize that, first of all, we don't know if any of it's true. We don't know. And even though I heard this fantastic story this week about a guy who practiced, you wanted the story, Tzvi will make you happy, a guy who practiced alternative medicine in Russia, and one day there was a woman who was brought to him who had flipped out, and she was making all kinds of noise and going on her hands and feet like an animal. And after analyzing her case, he had read in some books that in a forest in what they call St. Petersburg, in the middle of the forest there's grass that grows that if you bring it and you make a special concoction for this person, it'll cure them. So there's a specific time you could harvest it. He took a friend of his who was an athlete, and together they went into the forest. And they were told that there were all kinds of spirits in that forest. And they went hiking into the forest, day one, day two, and it starts pouring rain. Now they weren't dressed for this. They were dressed for a summer day, like they went out, and it's pouring and pouring, and they go in and they start hearing all these things on their way. And on the third day they come to this place where this grass is supposed to be growing, and they find the grass and they decide they're going to camp there because there's a specific time you're supposed to harvest the grass, and they're going to wait for that time to come. And then the night settles in, and they decide they'll take shifts. One will sleep, the other will stay awake. So they set up a bonfire and they're trying to warm up. It's been unusual weather. And his friend goes to sleep and he's sitting on guard duty, and he starts hearing all these voices talking and winds and voices, and he looks around, he can't see anything, right? He's in the middle of the forest, and he doesn't see anyone, but he hears a lot of things. And suddenly he sees his friend in the middle of his sleep starting to approach the bonfire. So he starts calling his friend, and he wants to get up and stop his friend from going to the bonfire, and he feels like he's being held back, and he tries to get up and he can't get up, and his friend is in his sleep crawling towards the fire. So he takes a stick and he pushes his friend back. Like that he could do, but he couldn't get up. And that's the only way he could keep his friend from climbing into the fire. And as the night continues, he feels drained of energy, and he's all the time he's hearing, and suddenly he starts hearing a voice telling him, who do you think you are? Why are you doing this? Why are you here? Who allowed you to come? Why are you here? And he's awake. He's not sleeping, right? So finally, in the morning, his friend wakes up. He's zonked because he hasn't slept all night. And his friend has had terrible dreams all night long. And he tells his friend, okay, let's get the grass and leave. They go to take the grass, and neither one of them has the energy to leave. And they both go to sleep, and they spend the next 3 days sleeping over there in the clearing. And then they went back to the city. He made the concoction for the lady, And he's on his way back and he starts hearing voices in his head. And they're telling him, who gave you a right to interfere? We had a right to do this to this lady. You have no right to interfere. Who allowed you to come and harvest this? Who allowed you to do this? And he went and he made the concoction and the lady got cured. And from that day onward, he left alternative medicine. He said after that experience, he wasn't willing to touch grasses anymore. He wasn't willing to deal with anything. Now the guy lives in our neighborhood. So you could say the guy's crazy. Maybe. I don't know. All these stories, you could say a person's crazy. So I decided that it's important to tell you guys something. There are things floating in the air all the time. And we don't notice them. And if you know how to access the different energies, you know how magicians always wave their hands, right? Then you could pull things out of the air, right? And then you'd say that's a different type of energy you've pulled out of the air, right? Did you guys ever notice how people pull things out of the air? And then you look at that and you say, that's an amazing energy. Look, maybe this guy can do something for me. So when I was a kid, they taught me this. They told me, wave your hands like this. Wave them. Reach into the air and pull out a handkerchief, right? Did you guys know how to do that, right? You access energies. And then they told me... They told me, though, that... when you take a handkerchief, drink a little bit of water. It was in the cup, right? And then, take my handkerchief, right? And then, over a cup that you just drank water from, right? Now watch it. It shouldn't go anywhere, okay? Put it in the cup, and then toss it to the guy and show it to him, right? Where did it go? So now I'm going to tell you a little trick. See, this is called the thumb tip, okay? You carry it in your thumb, but... and inside the thumb tip is a handkerchief. But if I didn't tell you that, if you know how to do it right, no one sees the thumb tip as you show your hands. You see, even though you know it's there, you don't know it's there. And then you reach into the air, and I poked it off my thumb, and then you pull a handkerchief out of thin air, and it's very impressive. Now, what's very impressive about it is that afterwards, if you want to be a really good magician, you tell people, I'm just going to rub it into the air, right? But it's here in the thumb. You see the thumb? You see? Right, but you didn't see that. And if I wanted to wave my hands at you, you wouldn't see it. So before you buy into all this nonsense, realize that there are a lot of tricks up people's sleeves. There are fake fingers you could put in between your fingers. Okay? No. If I wanted to pull you on, I could pull you on. I could put it in the cup. I could drink it. I could do a lot of things if I wanted to.
But this class has been recorded.
No, my point is, people hear stories, and then they're convinced. And there's a book, 50 Tricks with a Thumb Tip, okay? With this little thing, I could make water appear and disappear, right? You fill it with water, you wave your hands, and then you say, let me grab the energies in the air. You took off the thumb tip, yeah? And then you pour water out of your hand. Now, wow, he's holy, he's got water. I could put gold dust in here, and I could pour out gold dust and say, you know, you just tap the energies in the air, and you now can get gold dust. So before you buy into all kinds of things, take a step back and realize there's a lot of tricks out there, okay? There are watches that have such powerful magnets built into the watch that if you just wave your hand over someone else's watch, it'll go berserk. You could clean someone's memory from their phone because you have a watch with an electromagnet, and you just push a button and it turns on, and then you wave your hand over his phone, and wow, his phone went berserk and all the memory went wild. Look at what energies you have in your hand. There are chemicals that we have that we put in the thumb tip, and then when someone, when you want to show your energies, so you say, can I borrow your bracelet? Can I borrow your ring? And then you take the ring, you put a little bit of the chemical, you don't see the chemical, and what this chemical does is it reacts with human heat. And when the person puts the ring back on their finger or just holds it in their hand, it can reach 95 degrees. It could burn a person. The heat of that ring, I could put a curse on the ring, right? You won't see the chemical. And then I'm going to say, you know, I think you made a serious transgression. You didn't donate your gold ring to me. And if I'm right, then from now on, when you put that ring, it will burn you. Right? You didn't see the chemical. I give it back to you. You wear it. It starts getting so hot. How will you forgive me? And I go, look, maybe you have to give me two gold rings, right? A chemical that cost me 50 shekel, and I could convince you. I could put it on your glasses. And then when you wear your glasses, it'll get so hot, it'll literally burn. It reaches 95 degrees. the reaction with human heat reaches 95 degrees. And this is a chemical you don't see. And it's a chemical that doesn't hurt you. Only when it comes in contact with metal and human heat does it go up temperatures. So there are a lot of gimmicks out there. Before you buy into all these energies and everything else, if I didn't show you my thumb tip, then you'd be convinced with all kinds of energies. And again, I could play it much better than I played it. Because we're dealing with a biblical prohibition of people thinking that you have powers, I didn't want you to go on and think all kinds of things. But if I wanted to, I was a professional magician as a kid, I'm embarrassed to say, but believe me, I could convince you. If I took this this water and I poured it into my hand, and then I stuck my hand into the thumb tip, you guys wouldn't even notice it was here. And then I go, catch. And there was no water there. And you go, where'd it go? And I go, it's there. And they, oh. And then I pour it out. Wow, how'd he do that, right? He could access energies. But really, it's all the thumb tip. We're not mentioning the fingertips, that you can have spare fingers and people don't notice them. I'm saying, we're not mentioning the nail writer that you could put into your nail. It's a special, what do we do? I'm going to read all your minds. Each of you will think of a two-digit number, okay? So you'll each think of a two-digit number, and I take a notepad, and I make believe I'm scribbling on it. And then I say, what's your number? You tell me a number. He tells me. We go all around the room, and then I turn around the notepad. It has all of your numbers on. How did I do that? A nail writer. You have a thing that clips into the nail, which has a little piece of a pen or a pencil in it. And then he tells me his number. I write it with my nail writer. You can't see my thumb moving behind the pad, right? And I could write down every number. You thought I already wrote all those numbers initially. But really, I'm writing it down. Imagine this had a little tip that I could write with. So I tell him, okay, you guys, tell me all your I'm going to write down all the numbers you guys are thinking of. Wow. Okay, tell me your numbers. He tells me his number. As he tells me, I write the number, 76. Because I have a little pen in my thumb. You don't see it moving, right? He says 76. I write the 76. And later on, it seems like I wrote it beforehand when I moved the pen and you didn't see if I wrote or didn't write. So there are a million tricks to fool people. Don't be so quick to buy into things.
here's my question, though, about what you just said. You say you're ashamed to be a professional musician.
Because you shouldn't do it.
Musician. Yeah, but you're able to explain this very well to everybody.
Right, but when you do magic show, you don't explain it. The whole, you guys wouldn't enjoy it if I explained every trick.
No certain knowledge like this?
So I'm telling you.
Tell
what? I want more magic. No, yeah. So that's what I'm telling you. I'm telling you because all these stories, so I'm not saying they are real or they aren't real. I can't say. There are too many stories came up. But when people want to buy into let me pay so-and-so, he's got these powers, he's going to tell me, I wouldn't put my money there. I could convince all of you all kinds of powers that I have, and I just showed you one. I'm not saying the stories aren't real. I heard too many stories to say they're all nonsense. I don't know. I can't ignore what I've heard. I can't accept what I've heard. I'm in limbo. At the same time, I'm saying don't run and put your money by people who tell you they have powers because it's very easy to fool you to think I have powers. If I wanted to, you guys were all standing there in awe. I don't know why none of you knew the thumb tip, but now you know. It's one of the oldest secrets. It's one of the greatest secrets that magicians have. We walk around with thumb tips all the time. I don't anymore, but I decided today to bring it just so to dispel some of... even when you know it's there, right? Now you know it's there, right? But you can't see it. He can see it. You can't see it. Right? Because I've practiced for many years how to shift my hands. My hands are clean. You didn't see it. And now there's a kerchief. But again, you don't pull it out like that. You do like this. It's much more impressive. Right? You know it's there. You know it's there. You know it's there, but somehow you don't see it. Right? It's gone, but here it is. It's here. Okay. It's all a game. And again, making your watch stop and bending forks and all these have systems. The Torah says we're not supposed to deal with all this. Right. We have a machloket Rambam and Ramban in the Gaonim. Do we say it's all nonsense like Rambam says and the Torah told you don't go after nonsense? Or do we say there are forces out there like we learned in the Ramban, like we learned in the Ran, like we learned in the Gaonim, and the Torah says don't deal with those forces. Bottom line, these things can really destroy a person's life when they invest in them, when they try to pursue them. Torah says we give the death penalty if a man or a woman practice sorcery or witchcraft. Again, coming back to the question, is it real or is it not real? Are they really doing something?
Right.
Yes.
But this kind of illusion, it's okay to do.
No, I don't think it's okay to do.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, but there's a
like if it's clear, it's an illusion.
It's
like
not clear. It was only clear because I told you. If I didn't tell you, you'd believe it. You don't know. Everyone sitting here initially didn't know what I was doing. They didn't know how to understand
it. I see your point. But I'm saying that there's a difference between, is there the difference between real illusion and the actual magic?
I don't know. That's the question Rambam holds not. Rambam holds it's all a farce.
So if it's just a funny game where you're showing magic...
But you think they have powers. You think they have powers. Not you. I would finish a magic show and people would ask me to cure their sick. People believe there are powers. And you can understand that people believe that. Because if I told you I can access the energies and then I pull out a handkerchief and then, wow, isn't that amazing? There were energies there that you didn't see, right? So now you're a little bit befuddled. How did that happen?
But the majority of people believe it's not real. They just don't know it.
They have a question. Rabbi Feinstein says, like you and I have a very hard time.
I see
with
a magic trick. Like, I know I don't believe they actually did it, but I don't know how they did it.
Right. But if I made your cup levitate right now, if I made your payas flip forward and backwards right now, you know, we have special string that you can't see, what's called invisible string, and we use it. We have a special thin string called invisible string. So I would wave my hand this way and you wouldn't see the string and your spoon would do this and that. And I would just do this and that and I would say, you look at what energies there are. And your spoon would flip here and flip there. Who has a watch here? Can I borrow your watch?
Watch.
Any watch. Can I use this? Okay. I need everyone on that side of the table. We're going to continue the parsha. Your watch has excellent energy. I needed a watch. My own hand doesn't have the energies I need. Gabriel, I need you to sit next to Yosef Chaim. Everyone shift over there, please. I need you guys there. No one behind me. You don't stand behind a magician. It doesn't work. The energies don't flow right. No, you can sit here. Just not behind me. I'm going to show you a little trick I learned when I was a young man about energy. You just have to hold the watch really well. Okay. okay. They taught me this trick back in magic school. You hold the watch really well with your hand, and the energies flow from the watch, and it doesn't matter how you move your hand, the watch won't go flying. You just have to hold the watch and the energies stay. You guys know how I'm doing this? Yeah, how am I doing it? How am I doing it? What? Oh, you! What's holding the watch? The pen up. It's the energies of the. It's the energy. I'm sorry. You're right. You are so right. Wow. Ha ha. Okay. Okay, but you thought initially. What did you think? Okay. What energies, right? But when I moved away my hand, what were you thinking? Okay. So by now you know. But the misleading thing is that initially you thought you knew it was a finger, but when it wasn't the finger, now what is it? Thank you, Mr. Svensson, for the use of your watch. Where did my pencil just go? Here we go. So back to our story. Right? So the finger suddenly was not the finger, right?
Ronan missed the show.
So it's sort of like, look, I just lost my finger.
Right, exactly. So that's why I'm saying it's not... we come back...
What do you do in the army when you have to be a distraction? Hey, guys, what am I going to do with my
back to our there's special mitzvah. Torah says 36 times. I had a very nice idea. Why 36? To be nice to a convert. 36 times the Torah warns us to be nice to a convert. Now it's interesting that the number 36, this was, I just noticed this week, the number 36 is the numerical value of Ayeka, where are you? The Medrash says Hashem always asks the ger, where are you? I've been waiting for you. It says Hashem has a special love for gerim. So we have 36 times in Torah to be nice to a ger, and in our parsha we have two. One time the Torah tells us, don't hurt a ger monetarily, don't take advantage of them, don't be unfair to them in money. And another time the Torah repeats it and says, don't oppress a ger, and that the Torah tells us not to say something that will be hurtful to a convert. So the Talmud gives us all kinds of examples. I don't know that I have to mention them. Basically, it's not to talk to a person about their history. Not to tell the person you used to be, you used to, all kinds of things. What's interesting is that some converts, many converts, are very sensitive to the question of why did you convert? I wouldn't have thought that's a hurtful question, but experience has taught me that some people aren't happy discussing it, so I don't ask the question. I do sometimes as part of my job to get to know the guys, but it's asked too often.
It's like 5 times a day, like 5 times a day, so it's like...
Ask me the
question like every
single
second.
Yeah,
of the day.
We get chance to
fight
many questions.
Okay.
Do you know the journalist called Bethany Mendel?
No. So I didn't hear you.
Yeah. It's an everlasting question.
Yeah, it is. Ah, really?
Yeah. She.
You can be asked the same question in the family that you've been for like 5 times. You can be asked the same question.
And the many times you hear, and the many times you hear, you must be crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
Do what? Sorry.
Fascinating. Okay.
You don't know how many times I've heard it.
Exactly.
That exactly.
Wow.
Oh my God, how do I do it? Like my friend, he had no money.
You know what I mean? You've been friends with me for how many times I've heard it.
Wow. Okay. Okay, so we learned, those of us who are not converts, we learned that this is a sensitive thing. Okay.
This journalist I mentioned, she's her father was Jew, her mom knows, so she also did conversion, she's Orthodox, and she wrote this thing called the Bill of Rights for Jewish Converts.
Okay, send me, I'll be happy to read.
It's really interesting.
Okay,
really interesting.
So we have in our parasha two mitzvot about not hurting converts, be it monetarily, there's a special mitzvah not to be unfair to them, and verbally, not to say something hurtful. Next, we have a mitzvah in the Torah not to hurt a widow or an orphan. That means when we do business with them, we have to be kind, we have to be patient, we have to be merciful. You'll say business is business. Not with the person who has this hardship of being a widow and an orphan. How long is a person considered an orphan for? You know, the guy is 65 and he lost his father. Is he an orphan now? So our assumption is that an orphan is a term when a guy can't manage on his own. Once they're old enough that they manage on their own, then we don't call them a yosom, an orphan, anymore. A widow is a widow. Next, we have a mitzvah. We have the mitzvah of giving loans. So here, people have to be intelligent. Many people get very burnt by giving loans. A good friend of mine told me a rule. He said, "Don't lend money you can't afford to lose. Lend it if it won't destroy you that the guy doesn't pay you back. But if you're putting your whole financial future at peril, then he says don't do it." Torah doesn't give us that rule, but it might be good advice. So there's a special mitzvah to give loans. The flip side is people have to be very careful. People take this mitzvah and they sometimes really, really hurt themselves. So there hopefully are good opportunities where you could help someone, and a loan can sometimes save a person's business. But again, I've seen many businesses that people thought they were saving and they just ended up losing all the money. There's also a mistake that people make, that they think that they don't have to repay a loan, and that's evil. The Mishnah says that Rabbi Yochanan asked his disciples, what's an evil path to stay away from? And one of them gave the answer, a person who borrows and doesn't return what they borrowed. Lovei rasha v'lo yishalem. I have a special shelf in my house for things I borrowed, so that I won't forget to give them back. So why didn't I give them back yet if I borrowed them? Sometimes because the person lives on a different continent. We had a student who left the country. He lent me a book and left the country. So I still want to give him back the book, but he's not in the country. So he told me keep it. I don't want to keep it. It's his book. We had a student who forgot a book. He came to my house for a Shabbos meal. He left the sefer by us. Same story. Now he's out in Poland. I haven't seen him in years. So his sefer is by me. And so on. But over the years, I've given back a lot of the things that aren't mine. I have a special place for these things. A special place in the house so I can give them back. When a person doesn't repay a loan, so they're not only harming the lender, they're also harming the other people who might get a loan in the future, because the guy figures, how can I give a loan if these people didn't repay it? So we have a special mitzvah to give a poor person a loan, and this sometimes can save a person's business. Sometimes if a person can just get through a certain period in their lives, that will avoid financial collapse. There's a special mitzvah to give a loan. We have organizations that give loans. They're called gemachs, lending gemachs. Gemach is an acronym for gemilut chesed. It's good if you could let the professionals do it, because hopefully they can ensure they'll get their money back. They won't get burnt too badly, hopefully. So that's a good way to do to give loans. The Torah then gives us the mitzvah that a court has to go by the majority opinion. We then have the mitzvah of helping a person unload his donkey and reload his donkey. The Torah says you only have that mitzvah if the guy will work with you. A person can't sit on the side and say, you have the mitzvah, unload the donkey. You have the mitzvah, you load the donkey. No, the Torah says he has to work with you. Here we also see the Torah says if you see your enemy's animal suffering under the load, help him out. The Torah tells us, why does it describe your enemy? It tells us two things. Who's your enemy? Could be you know this guy, did things that are prohibited. You walked by and you saw him on Yom Kippur eating pork. You tell him, Shmendrik, this is pork. He goes, shh. You won't tell and I won't tell. So you can't do anything about it, right? Technically, only you know. But you know that this guy did something wrong. So you're upset at him. Torah says the next morning you see his donkey suffering under a load and your best friend's donkey suffering under a load. Who will you go to? Go to the guy you don't like. Conquer your desires, conquer your feelings, and say, I'm going to help him anyway. Special mitzvah in the Torah. No, we're out of time. We have the mitzvah of Shemitah, that on the seventh year, whatever the land produces, we leave, we let anyone access. We have to go back to the story of David, right? I'm sorry, okay.